Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Tolkien Road. John here, and Greta.
Hey, hey.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing well. A little bit of a somber day. Is that right? Is that the right term?
I think somber is the right word.
Yeah. We had planned to make episode 184, the second part of our discussion of Alderaan and Arrendis. However, the news came down yesterday that Christopher Tolkien, the last surviving son of J.R.R. Tolkien, passed away on January 15th in France. So he was 95 years old. That's an incredibly long life,
even today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well past, I think, life expectancy for your average man.
Yeah, so, I'd say so.
But I wanted, because of that and because of his huge role in his father's literary legacy, I wanted to devote episode 184 to him and to his memory. I think for anyone who has spent any time getting to know Tolkien beyond reading The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings knows what Christopher means to Tolkiendom. He gave us the Silmarillion. I mean, right there, you could just say that by itself.
Yeah.
And
it's an amazing contribution.
And don't get me wrong, he was the editor. He didn't write the Silmarillion. He was the editor. But you'll hear people who have really studied this subject and have just been looking at Tolkien's works for years, and you know, they'll put forth a pretty strong case that that he had much more, and he did much more for the Silmarillion than many realize, right? And then maybe he even took credit for, right? This is a man who spent the better part of his life devoting himself to getting his father's works out there and securing a legacy for his father and his works that I think would have made his father extremely proud.
Yeah.
And was maybe what his father hoped for. So I want to just spend some time really going over the high points of Christopher's life and then looking into his legacy and discussing, you know, what his legacy was for his father, for his father's works. We as Tolkien fans owe an incredible debt of gratitude to this man. And the thing that I kept thinking yesterday when I heard this news was, if we're going to be use an analogy, Christopher was to his father and his father's works what St. Paul was to Jesus. Right, Saint Paul is generally recognized as, you know, the greatest evangelist of the of Christianity in its first generation,
mm-hmm.
and I think the same could easily be said for Christopher. Right,
mm-hmm.
He did more than anybody else to extend the work of J.R.R. Tolkien into the public realm beyond just The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, absolutely, he did.
And you know, one thing that I think we'll discover is he had a very huge role in the development of The Lord of the Rings as well,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. He wasn't like he just came along after The Lord of the Rings, but the evidence is pretty strong that he was, you know, basically his father's primary draft reader.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Through the whole process of writing The Lord of the Rings. So, one thing I discovered was that in some of the research I was doing for this episode was that even with The Hobbit, he was paid two pence for every editorial note he provided to his father.
Wow.
Right? So he even with The Hobbit, like, he read that and provided editorial input to his father.
That's cool.
So, but let's just do a quick overview of Christopher's life, and just because this was a man who I think gladly stood in the shadow of his father when, you know, he was a man of remarkable skill and talent himself, and he did that when not like a lot of people wouldn't want to do that. But he,
yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
He
yeah.
chose to do that, and mm-hmm. you know, I mean, I'm sure there was financial benefit for it for him, but it's a tough, you know, it would be a tough thing for anybody to, you know, it's a tough thing. We always hear stories of like people standing in the shadows of others, sons standing in the shadows of their father, and you know, it seems to be a point of contention, but that doesn't seem to be how it was at all for him, which
no,
I just find fascinating.
Yeah, and it's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't realize until I was, you know, just kind of reviewing his Wikipedia page that, I mean, he was an author. Christopher yeah. was an author in his own right.
Yeah.
Like, a celebrated author. He received some awards and, mm-hmm. you know, recognition and things like that. But, you know, you hear the name Tolkien, you're not going to think of Christopher.
Right.
You're going to think of J.R.R., you know? So yeah, I think it's a beautiful testimony of just his love for his father and his father's works.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, let me kind of hit the high points of his life. So of Christopher's life. So Christopher was born on the 21st of November, 1924. He was the third and youngest son of J.R.R. and Edith.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course the fourth child was their only daughter, Priscilla. But so born November 1924, he was educated at the Oratory School in Reading in the UK. And of course, this is the Oratory School was the school associated with the Birmingham Oratory that John Henry Cardinal Newman founded. Back in the 19th century.
Well, okay.
Really fascinating stuff there that we'll eventually get into when we discuss the biography of Tolkien. And so he was educated at the Oratory School. Actually, there was a note that he was first educated at the Dragon School.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which
yeah.
I'm just like, that's how you get kids to like going to school, is you name them things like the Dragon
School. Or at least boys. Right. That's how you get boys to enjoy going right. to school. Girls, maybe not. But
they need more schools like those
the Princess
names.
Academy.
The Princess Academy, yeah. but of course, being born in 1924, he was the exact perfect age to be a partaker in World War II. So he entered the Royal Air Force during 1943 at the height of World War II, and fortunately, you know, came out alive. He seems to have, and I'm not going to get into his military career, but he seems to have. You know, not had to participate in a lot of the worst fighting of the war, and that may be a factor of like just having come into the war when the tide had really turned mm-hmm. in favor of the Allies.
Mm-hmm.
But he did, you know, he was a Royal Air Force pilot, and so you know, for all of that great generation, you know, we want to say like thank you for you know for
yeah.
what you did
mm-hmm.
And the sacrifices that you made for. For the friends you lost and you saw sacrifice themselves, right? You know, I just wanted to pay tribute to that. So, you know, he, like his father, he did his service when his country called upon him. And, you know, so we salute him for that. He studied English at Trinity College, Oxford, after the war. And I didn't know this, but he was also... he was also an Inkling. They
yeah,
invited
I didn't know
him to become
either.
An Inkling.
And he was the youngest
yeah.
member.
He was at 21 years old. He was apparently just such a brilliant guy that at 21 years old, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien and Owen Barfield and C.S. Lewis were like, "Hey, come, you're an Inkling now. Come join us," right?
That's so awesome.
And apparently as part of that, he was so of course this would have been like 1945, 1946. He was, and this is when Lord of the Rings was kind of in the throes of being composed by J.R.R. Tolkien, and he was basically invited by the Inklings. They were like, "Your dad's not a real good reader, so why don't you read it instead?" Right. So when he would bring drafts of chapters and that kind of thing, Christopher was actually the one that became the reader of those things,
so
that
read
the rest
it out
of the
loud.
Inklings could hear it. Yeah,
huh.
Which I thought was kind of a funny note.
That is funny.
So.
I'm sure his dad didn't mind.
Oh, you know. that's one of the themes that I feel like that's one of the reasons I wanted to pay tribute to Christopher is because like, as I look over the letter, I was trying to find like a good letter, like good representative letter to like read, mm-hmm. to show a little bit of their relationship, but there's too many. Like the book, I haven't done the math, but just based on what I was looking at this morning, he has to be the primary person that Tolkien wrote to throughout his life, right?
Like all, like everybody else. With. So not, you're not talking just as far as family goes. You're just talking in general, like between friends and
colleagues. Now he may, maybe we just have more of his letters on record.
Okay, because they were
more
chosen
permission
to,
or something,
yeah,
but.
Okay.
But, you know, based on the evidence that we have of the collected letters, it looks like Christopher received the most from his father, yeah. of anybody, right?
So I guess you would say he's the youngest of the three sons.
Yeah.
Sounds like out of the three sons, J.R. and Christopher were the closest.
Yeah, it really appears he was a chip off the old block.
Yeah.
You know, like, he was, you know, I mean, he was an Oxford... he was a philologist like his father, right?
Mm-hmm. And he also got the John Rule in his name,
Christopher,
which is unusual for a third born son. Usually that goes to the firstborn.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So, he was a part of the Inklings and it appears he was the number one draft reader and feedback giver for the Lord of the Rings. He also created the maps used in, the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. I was reading that, it said something about, like, I guess, like, the sketches that his dad would make. He'd look over, and they would be, like, contradictory. Like, they wouldn't make sense.
Yeah.
So Christopher would fix them.
It's like J.R.R. Tolkien and editor Christopher Tolkien. Like, you know, I mean, Christopher, like, the picture I get of him as I just get deeper and deeper into learning about him in researching for this episode is that he was pivotal. Like anybody who's ever created something knows how important a good editor is,
mm-hmm.
and having that voice to,
a trusted voice
to speak into what you're doing.
Yes.
And Christopher apparently was that voice. Right?
It's just crazy to think that like what we know of and what we've read of J.R. Tolkien wouldn't have been the same had Christopher not been a part of it.
I just like think of J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, he's just had this incredible mind that goes everywhere, right? And just like has all these things it wants to do. So many things, it just kind of gets overwhelmed by itself. And it's hard. It's like hard to just stop and focus on one thing. And it wants to, you know, keep on elaborating on this one little detail. And Christopher is there in the background and he can appreciate that.
Yeah,
but he's also like, but we gotta get this in focus, son. Right?
Focus, you know, focus, Dad.
Here's all these maps that you've made, and you can't decide on one. So here, let me take all of this, and we're gonna create an actual map, right? Mm-hmm. That's gonna be mm-hmm. the map, right?
Yeah, he was his dad's right hand man.
Certainly. So after the war, he became a lecturer in Old and Middle English as well as Old Icelandic at Oxford. He edited portions of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And then from 1963 to 1975, he was a fellow of New College, Oxford. So again,
he really is following in his dad's footsteps, right?
Academically, philologically, he was no slouch, right?
No, Old Icelandic,
right?
What?
Yeah. So, and really seems to have very similar interests in the mm-hmm. same languages, mm-hmm. like the same types of languages mm-hmm. as his father.
Yeah.
But in 1975, he resigned to devote himself full-time to his father's literary affairs. So this was 2 years after J.R.R. Tolkien would have passed away in 1973. The world still didn't have the Silmarillion. People knew of the Silmarillion, but you know, I can only imagine what it must have been like to be a fan of Lord of the Rings coming out in the early 50s, and then you have to wait, you know, 20 more years to hear about all these other stories,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It must have been the equivalent back then of what it was like for... you know, for Star Wars fans for so long, and that turned out very disappointing. but
that's a whole other conversation.
We're not going to go there. But, you know, Christopher was the... And so when Tolkien died, it was like, well, great, we're probably never going to get the Silmarillion now. But then Christopher comes along, and within 2 years of stepping down from this position at Oxford, the Silmarillion is finally released in 1977. And that's the book we have now, right? The Silmarillion as we have it now. So,
and he would have only been, 51 at that point?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, he had plenty of teaching years left if he wanted them.
Right.
So, I mean, I can't help but think that was a little bit of a sacrifice.
I think so. Yeah.
Again, not that it wasn't what he wanted to do and didn't have some financial gain in it, but still, you know, to choose to not continue to, you know, to make a name for yourself.
Well, it's just, you know, you think about it, it's like J.R.R. Tolkien and his son, Christopher, right? Yeah. Like, but, and he never, like, I don't know of any time he ever made a big deal about that. Like, you know, that, or he wanted to like, be like, well, can I please have some credit here? Right.
Yeah.
For everything I did.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just wasn't, he was content. And I don't think that was like this, like, stoic, you know, or cynical thing at all.
No, I think, I don't know.
I think he, like, what I see is just that he and his father, like, he just truly loved his father.
Yes, it was outpouring of just an incredible love and respect.
And these stories were a huge part of his life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
They were central to his life in so many ways. He grew up with these stories, mm-hmm. hearing them from his father.
Mm-hmm.
He saw all of the developments, and you know, it's just and so there's something to this that's so, like, it's so right, it's so odd in our world, but it's odd in our world because our world is so backwards and broken when it comes to the relationship between parents and their children,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
In so many ways. So
just also with the with the attitude of me first, right? Like, let me make a name for myself, and, you know, let people remember me. And, you know, and as humans, I think that's a very, you know,
mm-hmm.
innate response, but it's just beautiful when you see someone kind of shirk that.
Absolutely. So what I want to do before we get into, you know, maybe a little bit more editorializing on the legacy and his own views and some of the personal letters. I just want to read a list of. First, I'm going to read. I'm going to start with the things that were before he really became, you know, before his father passed away, when he was still focused on his own work. So in 1950, I can't tell what that is, but. In the 1950s, he published Tolkien, Hervarar Saga. I can't even read that because it's in a different language. I'm gonna need some help with that. So, you know, hear me out there, people. Hervarar Saga, Ok Hydrex. Tolkien Hervarar Saga Ok Hydrex Kunnings, right? And then the work on the Canterbury Tales, the Partner's Tale, the Nun's Priest's Tale, and then the Saga of Heidrek the Wise, and then the Man of Law's Tale, right? So this is all before the 70s. Then in 1975, this is when he really began focusing on his father's legacy. So 1975, actually before the Silmarillion, was Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, Pearl and Sir Orfeo, where he was the editor, and that is a work of J.R.R. Tolkien. And then 1977, The Silmarillion. Let's see, 1980, Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth. 1981, The Letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, which he's got a lot in there. 1983, The Monsters and the Critics and Other Essays. And then we start getting into the history of Middle-earth. The Book of Lost Tales, Part 1. The Book of Lost Tales, Part 2. The Lays of Beleriand. The Shaping of Middle-earth, The Lost Road and Other Writings, Tree and Leaf. Of course, that's a that was a previously published, but he edited it again and included Mythopoeia and the homecoming of the name I can't remember right now. And then The Return of the Shadow, The Treason of Isengard, The War of the Ring, Sauron Defeated, Morgoth's Ring, The War of the Jewels, The Peoples of Middle-earth. And then about a 10-year period elapsed until we got The Children of Húrin, the novel-length version of that tale, and then we got The Legend of Sigurd and Gudrun. Again, the writing is kind of small, y'all, so I'm sorry. And Gudrun, The Fall of Arthur, and then Beowulf, the Tolkien, the Elder Tolkien's translation of Beowulf. And then 2017, we got Beren and Lúthien. And then the last one, 2018, The Fall of Gondolin. So, I mean, that all, we have all of that because of Christopher Tolkien.
That's amazing.
We would not have that without his work. So, it really is the work he did over the course of his life. And anybody who has ever cracked open one of those books beyond the Silmarillion, I mean, the Silmarillion itself is a staggering, like, monumental work, right? But if you've ever cracked open Unfinished Tales or The History of Middle-earth, you see that a meticulous attention to detail that Christopher put into, like, getting those things right. I mean, they are more like academic works than they are like, you know, the books that you, it, I know, as like somebody who loves Lord of the Rings, when you first fall in love with that book and then you're like, all right, give me more Tolkien, and you go to the bookstore and you see, yeah, do people go to bookstores anymore? I don't know.
I think so.
But when I went to the bookstore back in the early 2000s, and you see all these like other, like, oh man, like the War of the Ring, The Treason of Isengard, like all these like Tolkien books on the bookshelf, and you're just like, wow. And then you open them up and you're like, this isn't like The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
it takes time to learn to appreciate them because they are of a more academic stripe. And I want to talk, maybe a little bit later about why that is and why that's important. But that's all of the works, you know, a list of the works. And I would guess there's probably ones that aren't on that list. Just knowing how extensive the library of Tolkien's works, is. So thank Christopher for having all of that.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, I want to maybe consider the whole question of his relationship to and his views of adaptations of his father's work. Christopher, I guess, has become most known in the wider culture as this kind of like curmudgeonly figure who just badmouths like Peter Jackson's films.
Mm.
And I really don't think that's the that's not the fair legacy for him. I even think it's his view of those things is actually far more complex than people probably realize.
Okay.
We all know what happens, right? We're all smart enough to realize that when it comes to the media and reporting on things, all the attention gets focused on the most salacious and controversial detail.
Of course, yes, yeah, because that's what sells. That's what people want to hear.
That's
most people,
for better or for worse, that's why there's so much.
We love drama.
And it's what sells, right? And that's why there is typically in our time there's a lot of there tends to be a lot of distrust from all kinds of perspectives towards the media and towards reporting, because and I don't want to get into any of that. Like, it being a good reporter, a good journalist, a good documenter of the facts is a difficult enough job as it is. But it is true that like all of the headlines got focused on Christopher being like, not a fan of these, Christopher Tolkien, Tolkien's son and primary literary executor, badmouths Peter Jackson's film or something like that. Right. Now, was he a fan of the films? I don't think so. He did, you know, he is on record as having said, they gutted the book, making an action film for 15 to 25 year olds, right?
So
that's from a 2012 interview.
So they didn't need his, like, they didn't need his approval to make these movies.
No, the rights had been sold a long time ago, and
like while JRR was still alive,
I believe so. I'm not up on the history of that, but
I didn't realize that.
But no, they did not need Christopher or the Tolkien estate's approval for doing Lord of the Rings.
Oh,
right,
okay.
So
those are strong words from Christopher. Gutted the book.
Well, and
yikes.
But let's think about it from his perspective, right?
Oh yeah, especially considering how much they meant to him, right, and how personal they were.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. You know, he thinks about, let me give you this perspective. All right. So let's look at the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien. Right. And let's go to like the period of, I'm looking at, you know, I'm starting in like 1943 when Christopher would have joined the Royal Air Force. And it's just like letter after letter is to Christopher Tolkien, to Christopher Tolkien, to Christopher Tolkien. And it's all like, it's all like discussion of, here's this latest chapter I've been working on. You know, we're now up to, the fellowship has now reached this point. Right. Mm. And, we don't have Christopher's correspondence back, but it's clear if you read the letters that he was corresponding back with his father. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Now there's other stuff like fatherly advice and kind of, you know, really beautiful sorts of like, I truly miss you, my son. Like, I wish you were here with me. Right. These kinds of sentiments, which are, again, a testimony to the really beautiful father-son relationship that these mm-hmm. two had.
Mm-hmm.
But my point in bringing that up now is to say, Christopher, for him, these stories were, they were a family heritage,
yes.
right?
Yes.
They were a unique gift, almost, you know, it's almost like sometimes writers and artists have to identify in their mind, right, who their primary audience is. And it's almost like Christopher was the primary audience for these mm-hmm. stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is still a decade out from the publication of The Lord of the Rings, right?
Okay.
And it's already 4 years after the publishers had started begging Tolkien for the sequel to The Hobbit. And so, as we recall, if you know anything about the history of the composing of The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien thought, like, there was a lot of uncertainty in his own life about whether he'd ever actually be able to bring it to completion, right?
Wow.
So, you know, Christopher, I can totally, while most of us, a lot of us have come to Lord of the Rings because of Jackson's movies, right? I can sympathize, or I guess I can empathize with with Christopher's perspective.
Yeah, I can too. It's almost like they were a part of him.
Yeah.
Like part of his DNA.
Right.
And
so for him, it's like the little details that were like, oh yeah, you know, they didn't do this detail right, but whatever, like it's still a cool film. For him, it's like every detail mm-hmm. is like this crushing blow.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like little daggers, like to his soul.
Like you just completely left out Tom Bombadil, who was three chapters of this story.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe Tom Bombadil was like Christopher's favorite thing.
Favorite character. Right? Could be. Could be. Yeah.
You have, he's like, no, you know, I know it's like this detail mattered because my father and I wrote back and forth about the right way to do this. Right.
Like for weeks. Like know? it was the subject of multiple correspondences, not just one letter.
Right.
Right. And he knows how much of himself his dad put into it.
Yeah.
You know? So it was probably like a double blow.
Before you write Christopher off as some kind of curmudgeonly old man who just, you know, was like, get off my lawn, you know, shouting, get off my lawn, like in futility. Think again.
Yeah.
Like that's just, mm-hmm. that's not the story. That's yeah. not who he really
Put
was.
Put yourself in his shoes.
And I will say this. I was looking, that's a quote from Wikipedia, the one I read about the action, making an action film for 15 to 25 year olds. And then I found on Tolkien Gateway, and I don't know what this quote is attributed to, but this quote is, I recognize that it is a debatable and complex question of art, and the suggestions that have been made that I disapprove of the films, whatever their cinematic quality, even to the extent of thinking ill of those with whom I may differ, are wholly without foundation. So there's some nuance here, right? Basically, he's saying, like, look, there's a lot of, like, I've somehow gained this reputation of completely disapproving of film adaptations, visual adaptations of my father's work. And that's just not true,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I think what he's trying to say there is, I actually feel free to take issue with things that I think are incorrect or of poor cinematic quality, but that doesn't mean that I think ill of Peter Jackson, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or even of the idea of making films. Right.
Right.
So now
right.
That quote doesn't have an attribution to it. So it I'd love to see the attribution, because I'd love to read the longer interview where it came from. So if anybody can find that, you know, that'd be cool if you'd send it to me. So, you know, we can kind of see that, like, it's really not about this, like, oh, you know, don't make movies of my father's films. It's more of like, if you're going to do it, would you please just do it right?
Right.
Would you please just honor what we
yes
worked on, yes, right?
That's the real issue.
What he made, right?
Honor and respecting.
And honestly, like, I can sympathize with this, because I remember in 2003 when I saw Gollum on the freaking MTV Movie Awards, or Music Awards, or whatever it was. Like, I'm like, what are they doing? Like, you can't just put Gollum on anything.
Yeah.
Like, who do you think you are?
Well, they technically can, because they have the rights.
Well, but that's the thing. But, and they have right. the legal right.
They
but
have
it's
legal
like,
rights, but yes.
But it's like, here's this, you know, pop culture. Like, I'm not anti pop culture, but pop culture in its worst form has this way of taking things that are wonderful and beautiful and have kind of a sense of being a little bit sacred to them and just flattening them, right? And Gollum went from being this, like, the really, like, tragic, fascinating figure that he is in Lord of the Rings to being this, like, tool of, like, stupid comedy, mm-hmm. right? Like, not, mm-hmm. like not even satire, but, like, just what's slapstick?
Yeah, I was
right?
gonna say slapstick.
Just
yeah.
like slapstick comedy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
it's just a complete misuse.
And that bugged the crap out of yeah. me. Right? That bugged the crap out of me. So
just inappropriate.
What that you know, what to me what that says is like there's
a lack of understanding.
Well, there's an absolute place in the world for quality control, right? And for course. Being the one that stands up and says, no, like I don't care if there's all kinds of. Christopher probably could have made oodles and oodles and oodles of more money if he had just signed on the dotted line and written it all off, and just merchandised and licensed the heck out of it. Now, again, like I understand that it's already there, like for a lot of Lord of the Rings stuff, but I think there was a you know. That'd be an interesting topic to explore sometime. The ins and outs of the contracts that were signed by Tolkien back in the day that have now become this, you know, kind of got out of control maybe and got away from him, right? Mm. But Christopher was also probably very much aware of the kinds of proposed adaptations for Lord of the Rings that had come out, you know, that J.R.R. had rejected, right? You know, there's a famous letter where somebody had proposed to do an adaptation of Lord of the Rings in like the 60s. And Tolkien's just like, you have just totally like bludgeoned my story. Right.
Bludgeoned.
Like you've changed. You just don't even understand it. You just want to make a few bucks right off of my story. So this happens in the world. And I'm just honestly, as someone who really loves Tolkien and is like now devoted a good part of my life to just exploring, Tolkien's worldview, his philosophy, the what drove him to create these works, everything behind it, I'm very thankful to Christopher that he held the line, right?
Yeah, he protected.
And I think he knew that he was probably fighting the long defeat,
yeah.
right, in this regard. You know, that one day he too would pass on, and there likely wasn't, you know, and apparently, like, I don't want to get into any real gossip about this, but there are indications that he and Christopher and his son Simon had a falling out for a good period of time over this topic, right? Like
over the movie adaptations.
Over the movie adaptations and how much they should they be like allowing people to make movie mm-hmm. adaptations. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, you know, I think they reconciled a few years ago. And I think, you know, who knows what Christopher's real opinion of the Amazon upcoming Amazon show was going to be. I don't know if he actually gave his blessing or if he was just like, I'm retiring and that's no longer my decision. But I have to think that there is this, I, I, th- I think there is this driving force that they do it right. And even the hiring of Tom Shippey to be the advocate for keeping true to Tolkien, right? Keeping true to Tolkien's legacy and his philosophy and the works. Just the fact that they have this kind of quality control guy in place on mm-hmm. the show, on mm-hmm. the staff of the show,
mm-hmm.
I have to feel like is part of Christopher's legacy as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That Tom Shippey has effectively this veto, right? And representing the Tolkien estate over mm-hmm. getting things wrong. And that's encouraging to me because Tom Shippey is an academic and a details guy on the level of both Christopher and J.R.R. Tolkien, right?
Yeah.
So
that's good.
Yeah. So
it's good that he's a part of it.
So, you know, think about, think about some of the other adaptations that have been done. Think about the questionable, you know, the still controversial question of like, you know, they're Lord of the Rings, people tend to be a little happier with as a movie. The Hobbit, people are a lot more like, you know,
don't
what is this?
Don't even get me started.
So, and there's, you know, different camps on it. Some people love it. Some people hate it. But you even go back to like the animated versions of Lord of the Rings that came out, which we haven't really watched, but I know have a lot of detractors. If somebody is not holding the line for these things, people will just do whatever they feel like with
them. Well, sky's the limit. Yeah.
They'd be like, I think it would appeal to more kids if we did this. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, mm-hmm. we can make a lot of money if we have Gollum show up at the MTV, you know, movie awards. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. You know, so, it's just, what Christopher did here was he set a precedent with Tolkien's legendarium beyond The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings that it was sacred and you don't mess with it and you got to be true to it. Mm-hmm. You can't just do whatever you feel like doing as a creative.
Yep.
So,
yeah. And that's invaluable. Truly.
It truly is. And I think all Tolkien fans, us Tolkien nerds who are nerdy enough about Tolkien to listen to a podcast about him, we owe Christopher that debt of gratitude, right? For holding that line, for fighting the long defeat in that regard. And I'm hopeful that it will truly result in something that we can all be happy with when it comes to Latron Prime.
Yes. Agreed. So, yeah. Yeah, that had to be like, that wasn't fun work, you know, like being that guy.
I've never had somebody, you know, I've never been in a position where my name is all over the media, you know, is this curmudgeonly figure. So mm-hmm. I don't know what that's like, but
I can only imagine.
I can only imagine it's not very fun.
Not fun.
Right.
No. Of course, for all those there, I'm sure there was plenty of encouragers, people like you and other lovers of Tolkien's works that were, you know, his cheerleaders, but they were probably much less vocal. You know, he probably didn't hear as much from them.
Right.
Because that's not what the media shares.
Well, you know, at some point, I think the whole concept of like public domain, like something entering into the public domain is right. I think at some point things just become so, they become a part of history and they become a part of the cultural legacy of, you know, of humanity. Mm-hmm. Right. And, mm-hmm. But I do think there is something to be said for when you're talking about the meanings of things and the way adaptations should be done, that you need to pay attention to what the writer intended. That's not the whole story, right? That's not everything. Tolkien would be the first to admit that there were unintended things in the stories, right? That he maybe only discovered later, right? So, you know, it's not like someone tells a story, someone writes a song, someone paints a picture, and they have what they're intending to do. But there's also, like, the best art will result in things that are unintended consequences. And, I didn't even know that was in there, right?
Yeah.
I hadn't even made that connection.
Yeah.
Right? But a principle, it seems, in, like, in adaptations and analysis should always be, like, to get closest to the writer's own view of their work, right? The artist's own view of their work.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It should start with them. Mm. And people are, I think, way too cavalier about this kind of thing today, right? Like, you know, well, we want to do the, you know, this perspective on this story, you know, and it's all kind of the cute thing to do with Shakespeare nowadays. And again, like, I think eventually, like, that becomes a thing, and that's fine. Shakespeare happened 500 years ago. So it's fine that there's all kinds of different spins on,
yeah,
this, on
like
the stories
10 things
of Shakespeare.
I hate about you, right, as a Taming of the Shrew adaptation.
It's a cultural, yeah, it's the cultural legacy of humanity now. And it's kind of, it's passed into that stage of just being like one of our myths that we have and we trade on as the human race.
Right.
But Shakespeare did originally intend something when he wrote those right, plays. Right. Yeah. So yeah, if we want to get back to that, if we want to understand the core meaning of something, we have to go back to his voice and his views on things. And just the same as it comes, as it would be with Lord of the Rings, right? Yeah. Or any of, or the Second Age of Numenor, or, you know, the Silmarillion, or whatever it is.
Yep, the buck stops there.
Exactly. So, or at least it starts there.
It starts there, and then
it
starts
should be the
and
primary
stops
focus.
There. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So, so anyway, Christopher, thank you for holding that line and for fighting the long defeat when it comes to being the, like, securing the integrity of your father's literary legacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thank you when people were like begging for probably sequels and prequels and, you know, action movies and, yeah, you know, and this kind of stuff, that you were like, that's not really what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And, mm-hmm, and I think I hope and I pray that we've reached a time, like, culturally where we're beyond that, like, let's just cash in on this famous story and this trademark to make a big buck.
Mm-hmm.
And people realize that fans, audiences, want to see stories that are true
to
the original,
yes,
work, right?
Yes.
That we really want to see that we love the original work, and that's why we want to see it on the screen, but we don't want to see your spin on it. We want to see something that has the same integrity, mm-hmm, as the original work.
Yes.
And the same meaning as the original work.
Exactly.
All right. So
here's a question.
Yeah.
So now that Christopher is gone, is there kind of someone that's like next in line to kind of, to hold the line, to kind of be the protector of the works of Tolkien?
I don't think we'll ever have anybody that's on the same level,
well,
there,
no,
as Christopher,
but I mean,
because there was that personal relationship,
right,
between,
absolutely,
father and son.
Sure. But I mean, someone that's, well, you know, it's not just gonna be a free for all now.
My understanding is that Christopher's son Simon is like the main guy now at the Tolkien estate.
I see.
No, I'm not
100%
sure about that. But
I see. Okay,
that's my understanding.
Okay.
So, and I think Simon maybe has a little bit of a different view.
It sounds
of it
like
all.
He might. Yeah.
I don't. Again, I don't want to, like, start this thing where Simon's like the opposite of Christopher, but I think he's probably, you know, he's of a different generation and a different,
yeah,
mindset.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I'm sure the next generation of Tolkien children, who are probably more like our age, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are probably even more of a different mindset. So,
yeah.
And I think, I just think the time is probably right. You know, I've been saying for years that the future of Tolkien stories needs to be in that more long form, prestige TV show kind of format, right? Like, because novels really deserve to be adapted into a TV, like, into a longer TV show.
Right.
Like,
or like a miniseries.
Especially if they're detailed works, right?
Yes.
Yes. With numerous characters and,
mm-hmm,
and these sorts of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, so just to, you know, we've talked a lot about his relationship with his father. It's really hard to pick out any just, you know, one letter. I'm just a couple of quick notes on that, just to illustrate that. There's so much in the letters, so much in Humphrey Carpenter's biography. I found this really, really moving. This is towards the end of Tolkien's life. It says when he moved to Bournemouth, which I'm not, I think that's just somewhere like in England. I think this is, so he and Edith are very old at this point. And, it says he wrote to Christopher, a year after moving to Bournemouth. And he said, I feel quite well. And yet I see no men of my own kind. I miss Norman. And above all, I miss you. Right.
Mm.
And it's not like this was like this, like, stunning admission about, you know, his love for his son. Like, that's one of numerous times when he would just express how much he loved his son.
Mm-hmm.
So as a father, like, I can only, I just, I just pray that, like, when my own kids are, you know, are adults, that I transition from this relationship as, I mean, I'll always be their father, but it transitions from, you know, the more fatherly role to the, to just one of, like, true friendship.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of true intimate friendship. And it's clear that that's what happened with Tolkien and with J.R.R. and Christopher.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, another quote from a later letter. This is 1971. He says to Christopher, "I am longing to see you. I'm sure there are many more things which I shall remember as soon as this is posted that I wish to say. But what I personally need, probably more than anything, is 2 or 3 days general consultation and interchange with you." He just wanted to spend time with Christopher.
Gosh, this is like making me tear up.
It does, right? He truly loved this son. And
yeah, don't you? Like, yeah, I feel the same way. Like, when our kids are adults, like, I want to spend time with them.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I want to just enjoy them as human beings.
So, if you read the period in the letters from 1943 to about 1945, you'll just see letter after letter to Christopher, and you'll really get a full flavor of their relationship during that time. And again, you know, Christopher is off training for the Royal Air Force during this time, and with a war going on, right? And so, you know, there's always in the back of the mind, probably is J.R.R. is the father, and having gone through war himself and lost friends, there's probably always this thought of, like, I might never see my son again.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's almost like this lingering urgency in the background of a lot of the letters.
Mm.
But
say all the things just in case.
Right. Yeah. But I loved this. Okay. So this is, and I think this is where I want to end it all. Just kind of end this episode and this tribute to Christopher. And by, I think this really ties it all together well. In a letter of 12 May 1944 to Christopher, J.R.R. wrote, "Spend a morning writing, and we are now in sight of Minas Morgul." Right? So, you know, he's relating to him where he is in the process of writing Lord of the Rings. "Gardening in sultry and properly midday heat this afternoon. I have done nothing about getting new copies typed to send to you of fresh chapters, as I am pushing on while there is a chance and cannot wait to make fair copy. Very much love to you, and all my thoughts and prayers. How much I wish to know." And then this is really the kicker. He quotes what would later become part of Lord of the Rings. "When you return to the lands of the living, and we retell our tales, sitting by a wall in the sun, laughing at old grief, you shall tell me then." And I just think, like, that's what they're doing now. You know? I pray that's what they're doing now. And you know, these two lifelong friends who are father and son, you know, that they're laughing at all the old grief of their lives as they sit by the, you know, by this wall.
Yeah.
And then spending eternity with one another.
Same.
Yeah.
Same.
Well, thank you all for listening. And, you know, I just want to send thanks out to Christopher. And thank you for your life and what you gave to all of us as fans of your father's work. And thank you for putting up with all of the annoyances and all of the craziness that we often brought to you and your family. and for staying true to your father and his vision for this world we all love of Middle Earth. And
yeah, such a gift.
We will do our best as fans to continue to stay true to that. And we just thank you.
Yeah, indeed.
All right, y'all, thanks for listening, and yes, we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.